We should be leading the way, not only because we've contributed far more to the problem of climate change than most other countries because of our industrialization, but also because it's just the right thing to do. You know, we laud our scientists and academic institutions when we don't listen to what they're telling us we need to do.
Hi there, and welcome back to another episode of Sustaining with Shayna, a show where I will share all the amazing and exciting works of sustainability happening across the eastern foothills of the Appalachian Mountains to the lush farmlands of southeastern Pennsylvania. By celebrating our community, we can help to bridge the gap between local and international sustainability endeavors. Today's guest is Flora Cardoni. Flora is Penn Environment's field director, where she oversees working with volunteers and staff across the state of Pennsylvania, mobilizing to fight for climate issues, whether that's climate change, clean energy, or eliminating single-use plastics. So today during the episode, we talk about a variety of issues that overlap with climate and environmental policy. And we talk about that not just at the local and state level, but we also dive into the national and international level and how tomorrow's presidential election plays a role in all of that. Hi there, friends and listeners. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Sustaining with Shayna. On this special episode that airs right before the U.S.'s election day on November the 3rd, don't forget to vote, we talk about a variety of issues about climate policy and environmental policy. Both are near and dear to my heart. And I think this episode is a critical one to tune in before the election, especially with all the chaos that's happening right now across the country. We're trying to figure out what's going on, and in the process, we're trying to make sure that everybody gets out the vote. But I think we also need to keep in mind that even though tomorrow is election day, a lot of these issues are still going to be a problem even after the last ballot is cast. And climate change is one of those. And with climate change being an existential issue, we can't lose focus on whoever is president or whoever is inaugurated in January of 2021. We need to still keep in mind that the climate crisis is here and that it's very real. So with all that also said is, unfortunately, because of the failed climate policies, or I should say lack thereof, of the Trump administration, the U.S. will officially, as of Wednesday, November the 4th, be officially withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement. So for some might think, well, that's not necessarily the worst thing that can happen, or even though the U.S. has left the Paris Climate Agreement, the U.S. is still doing things to acknowledge that, whether it's at the local or state level. But having gone to two UN climate negotiation conferences, that I've realized of how much the impact the United States makes on a global stage in those rooms and halls of negotiations around climate policy. And it just really goes to show that the U.S., as of when I was at COP25 in December of 2019, the way the US was either actively trying to stop good climate policy from being carried out or just stopped having a voice or just stopped doing any real impact or positive change. So even though us Americans that walk into the voting booth tomorrow, or those of us who have dropped our mail-in ballots off at our official locations, we don't necessarily see those interactions firsthand. And sometimes it's hard to grapple with that and understand what some of these implications are. And unfortunately, if we continue to go down the road of these same failed climate policies, it'll only get worse. So unfortunately, like many other issues that should not be on the ballot, unfortunately are, and climate change is one of them. So I don't really have much to say. I know last week's episode, I kind of talked about the election and the process and climate change for a good 10 minutes before the guest came on the show. All I just want to say between now and election day is make sure you vote. And I know after talking to some voters over this past weekend while canvassing that a lot of people just don't want to vote for president. And if that's your choice and that's what you decide, don't forget that there are plenty of great, wonderful down ballot candidates that could use your vote. So even if you don't decide to vote for president, even though it's very important to do so, please understand that you shouldn't not vote at all. Because there's plenty of other great leaders who we could elect that could do things at our local level here, whether it's state or representing our state and our community at the national level, such as Congress. So if you have not gotten your mail-in ballot, some of you, unfortunately, out there probably haven't. I advise you to go to the polls tomorrow and try to vote by provisional ballot, especially those of us here in Pennsylvania. But if you do get your ballot before Election Day and you have not returned your ballot yet, you will not be able to mail in your ballot and it be received in enough time to be counted. So, wherever you live, whether it's here in Pennsylvania or if you live somewhere else in the U.S., please make sure you find out where your mail-in ballot drop boxes are so you can properly deposit your ballot so it is officially counted. Because we constantly keep seeing in the news these last few days that certain elected officials are doing whatever they can to stop people from voting. And another thing I'll say to listeners out there who I think also probably feel this way in addition to some of the voters that I knocked on their doors this past weekend is a lot of us feel like our vote doesn't count and that our vote is not important. Well, it might seem that way, but elected officials wouldn't be trying to suppress our vote or steal our votes if it wasn't that important. And seeing how voter suppression is really high in these last few weeks before the election, that just goes to show of how critically important our vote is. So I'm going to leave it there and stay tuned for our guest of the show this week for a lively discussion where we talk more about environmental and climate policy. So stay tuned. Welcome back to another episode of Sustaining with Shayna. And here we are, only the Friday before the election, and we are throwing down some important discussions today, talking about the importance of policy and what that means, not just for the general election in November, but also what does that mean going forward. And I have a great guest on that can lend that knowledge to both local and national work and policy that's being done. So without further ado, she's going to introduce herself. So take it away.
Thanks so much, Shayna. And hello, everyone. My name is Flora Cardoni, and I am here on behalf of Penn Environment. Should I go ahead and explain a little bit about Penn Environment and what we do? Awesome. So Penn Environment is a statewide people-powered environmental advocacy nonprofit here in Pennsylvania. We believe, like you, that everyone deserves to have clean air to breathe and clean water to drink, protected open spaces to enjoy, and a safe and livable climate powered by 100% renewable energy. And right now, I serve as Penn Environment's field director. And in that role, I work with a team of organizers, as well as volunteers and activists all across the state to help make sure that everyday Pennsylvanians, like the folks listening to us today, have a voice in the environmental debate. So we really make sure that our elected officials and leaders at every level, local, state, and federal, are hearing from real people, the real people of Pennsylvania, and not just from, you know, the fossil fuel and other industry lobbyists who have their ear in Harrisburg and really just want to maintain the polluting status quo. So at Penn Environment, we work to help mobilize and energize Pennsylvanians on some of the most critical environmental issues facing the Commonwealth, from climate change and fracking to reducing air and water pollution to getting off of single-use plastics, and really work to build the people power and visibility that's needed to push the politics forward and change the equation in the minds of our elected officials so that we can actually win and pass good environmental policies that will protect our air and water and lands and climate and public health moving forward.
Sounds like your organization does a whole host of things, and having worked with you on some projects here and there over this last year, there's so many different things that Penn Environment does that it's just like, it's hard to wrap your brain around.
Yes, we definitely stay busy.
Yeah. So kind of then taking that another step further is, how would you explain how Penn Environment advocates for climate-friendly policy?
Yeah, that's a great question. So at Penn Environment, we use a mix of, you know, the people-powered grassroots advocacy that I was describing, you know, helping people be informed and have the tips that they need to comfortably, you know, write to and call their elected officials more often. We set up meetings so folks can lobby with their elected officials right now virtually, but in normal times, face-to-face in district or in Harrisburg. Or DC, even at the federal level. So a lot of helping people make their voices heard directly to their elected officials. We also do a lot of media work and visibility raising. Of course, issues like climate change are never covered in the news enough. And so we do whatever we can to release, you know, reports about climate change or clean energy, or host big events, or submit letters to the editor and op-eds to papers, and help volunteers do that as well, so that, you know, climate change is actually being in the news and the solutions that we're calling for are being talked about. And of course, we do our own lobbying directly as staff, helping to write and introduce bills, meeting with elected officials, answering environmental questions, and really trying to push forward these good environmental policies. And I think one great example of that, to help paint folks a little bit of a clearer picture, is some work that Penn Environment's done around 100% renewable energy, which I mentioned earlier. So I can kind of walk through our work around that as an example of the type of work that we do across environmental issues in Pennsylvania. So as we've talked about before, Shayna, the science is very clear that in order to, you know, stop the worst impacts of climate change, we do need to fundamentally change the way we produce and consume energy and transition away from all fossil fuels, coal, oil, fracked gas, to a 100% renewable energy future where we get, you know, clean renewable energy from the wind, solar, water, et cetera. And in the absence of leadership or really an opportunity to move forward at the federal level, which we'll get to later, Penn Environment has spent a lot of time over the past few years pushing forward that vision of a renewable energy powered future in the Commonwealth. So a few years ago, our executive director, David Mazur, sat down and worked with some of the environmental champions in the state legislature, some experts in the state and nationally, to write a bill that would set Pennsylvania on the path to 100% renewable energy by 2050 at the latest, but with benchmarks, I believe 50% renewable by 2030, 80% by 2040, 100% renewable electricity by 2035. So benchmarks along the way, but basically to write a bill that would set Pennsylvania on this path towards this renewable energy future. And we based that legislation off of work that was being done in states like California and New Mexico and Massachusetts on similar bills. We then worked to find a Democratic state representative and Republican state senator to introduce that bill so that it would be introduced with bipartisan support. It was actually the first bill in the nation calling for 100% renewable energy, where a lead sponsor was a Republican, which we know here in Pennsylvania, bipartisan support is critical. So once we, you know, found those folks to introduce the bill and had a good bill to work on, we then worked with in-state experts to show how it was actually possible for Pennsylvania. So we released a number of reports about and fact sheets about renewable energy, about climate impacts and why this transition was necessary, about what this could look like in Pennsylvania. And then it was really up to me and my team of organizers and volunteers and activists across the state to, as I mentioned, raise visibility around this and build support for it. So we've, you know, generated dozens of letters to the editor and op-eds to papers. We've pitched reporters on this idea of 100% renewable energy in the news. And we really worked to build up grassroots support across the state, you know, collecting thousands of petitions, generating hundreds of calls, bringing hundreds of people to Harrisburg in 2019 for our annual lobby day, doing almost 100 district meetings with elected officials. And by the end of 2019, we had actually signed on 100 co-sponsors for 100% renewable energy. So legislators who are signed on and say they support this vision, which, to be frank, in 2017, when we first started this campaign, even other environmental groups in the state told us we were a little bit, you know, too ambitious, setting a 100% renewable energy goal and didn't think anyone would support it. And I just think that speaks to the power of grassroots organizing to show actually, you know, we have thousands of people in Pennsylvania that want this future, and just leverage that people power so our elected officials, you know, see it and are encouraged to take action. And even during the pandemic, we've been doing that work. We had a virtual lobby day with more than 450 Pennsylvanians doing 100 video meetings over Zoom with elected officials. We've been doing big events and webinars and generating support online. So even during the pandemic and all the other challenges we're facing right now, I've been really encouraged because all of our activists and volunteers and members and the majority of Pennsylvanians are still making their voices heard and calling for real climate action on 100% renewable energy future. And our work is just to make that as easy as possible for folks to get involved and make their voice heard in the most effective way possible. And so that the work that they're doing is backed up with the best, you know, science and health-based standards.
Yeah, and I think you you answered a lot of things that I was just going to ask in as a follow-up question to that, but we can dive a little bit deeper too. That's all right. But as far as like, do you have any updates or recent, as far as like local, maybe it's like to certain parts of Pennsylvania or statewide or national bills being passed, whether that's some of the stuff that you've worked on or some of the bills that also if I can use my words to explain what I'm saying, like other partnering organizations have done too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I wish I had more uplifting news on that front. While things like 100% renewable energy and working towards this better, you know, vision of a sustainable future is, I think, the most exciting work that we do and things that I'm happy to work with you on, because I think it's so important to help folks see that vision of a sustainable 100% renewable energy powered future and work towards it. Unfortunately, the reality at the state level and national level lately has been just defense and just trying as hard as we can to stop the rollbacks to common sense environmental and climate policy that had already been in place. Whether that's the Trump administration rolling back the Clean Power Plan and the, you know, clean cars, fuel efficiency standards, or here in Pennsylvania, constant attacks to our environmental regulations and constant efforts to undermine the DEP to be able to actually effectively regulate air and water and climate pollution. We've just been having to do a lot of work to mobilize people around stopping those attacks, which is sometimes effective and sometimes not, given the makeup of our government at the state and federal level right now. So a lot of the things that we've been doing have been opposing bad bills. Mm-hmm. Most recently, there's been a few policies that we've been working to oppose at the state level here. One is House Bill 2025, which if anyone listening wants to call their state senator and state representative about, that would be great. This is a bill that would prevent Governor Wolf from joining the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. The Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, for folks listening, is one of the nation's most successful climate programs to date. It's a bipartisan initiative that every state is part of on the East Coast from Maine to Virginia, except Pennsylvania. And the program works by setting caps for carbon pollution from power plants and then lowering those caps each year, which is reducing carbon pollution dramatically, but also investing the funds raised into renewable energy and energy efficiency and home weatherization and other programs that help us cut emissions even further. And this is a bipartisan program. Not only will it lower pollution, but it will create jobs, help folks struggling to pay their heating bills and more. And House Bill 2025 would prevent Governor Wolf from being able to join RGGI. And what's worse, it would actually prevent the Department of Environmental Protection from being able to regulate carbon pollution at all, which we need to be able to do to tackle climate change. So,
can I stop you there a second?
Yes, absolutely.
It's the two important key items in that bill, mm-hmm. if it were to be passed.
Absolutely. So House Bill 2025 would prevent the governor from having Pennsylvania join the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and it would prevent the Department of Environmental Protection from regulating carbon pollution being under their jurisdiction. So it would force the state legislature to be in charge of any efforts to regulate or decrease carbon pollution, which might be fine if the state legislature showed that they were willing to do so. But we've had, you know, year after year of it being very clear that the state legislature is only attacking our, you know, environmental programs like this. And are pretty unwilling to pass something strong to actually regulate carbon pollution. So it would severely, you know, impact our ability to actually start decreasing carbon pollution, which we need to do to stop the worst impacts of climate change.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this bill passed already with huge margins of support in a bipartisan way. Luckily, Governor Wolf vetoed it, but now at Penn Environment, we're working to make sure that he has enough votes to uphold the veto. So the state legislature with 2/3 of a majority can overturn a veto or override a veto of the governor. And we are encouraging folks to call and write to their state legislators and ask them, you know, if an override effort happens, to stand with the governor and uphold the veto of this bad bill. So that's been one priority. And of course, in general, just raising support for joining the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in general has been a big priority. There's about to be a public comment period starting in about mid-November through early January. So folks should certainly, you know, make your voice heard there, make it clear that you want us to join this initiative and start actually regulating our carbon pollution. So yeah, that's a little bit about RGGI and carbon. There's a few plastics things going on too. I don't know if you want me to get into that now or maybe save it for another time.
I mean, I think since we're kind of on this path right now as far as bills, we could talk about that. But I kind of wanted to pause at the whole RGGI thing before we talk about the plastic-related bills. Is that, yeah, just like you said, just reiterating the fact that every state in the Northeast is a part of RGGI except for Pennsylvania. And the fact that I think that's hard for us to picture as Pennsylvanians, but I could be wrong, but I think statistically still, we are the 19th largest economy in the world, not just in the state of Pennsylvania, like in the country. And just to give the power and the impact that that could mean in other parts, but also it just shows the fact that we still are addicted to this dirty industry that is polluting our environment here in Pennsylvania, and it's not even going to benefit all of Pennsylvanians. And just imagining what a more sustainable energy industry could mean for Pennsylvanians. But I don't know. Every time people talk about RGGI and the fact that we're stalling with that I just come back to the idea that it's like we as in our legislature is stopping Pennsylvania from more economic opportunities too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's very frustrating because it's certainly, you know, economics aside for a moment, which I know it's hard to do, especially as an elected official, but there's no reason that we should be using this dirty and antiquated energy that is polluting our air and water, making people sick in a variety of ways around the state, you know, running pipelines by our preschools and playgrounds and homes, you know, making workers sick, making residents sick, and contributing to climate change in a way that if we don't rein it in, we'll feel, I mean, already we're seeing the impacts of climate change in Pennsylvania and around the world. And I don't know about you, I think this is why we both do this work. I constantly am worried about what our future is gonna look like under the climate crisis, let alone future generations. And there's just no need to be still, you know, shooting chemicals and water into crevices of shale to extract gas and leak methane and pollute our water and cause all these problems when we could just harness, you know, the clean renewable energy from the sun and wind that is all around us. So from a public health perspective, climate perspective, environmental perspective, and sustainability perspective, it just makes no sense. Like we should just be using this abundant, renewable, clean energy, and we have the technological capacity to power our country that way today. So exactly what you were saying. The only reason that we're not is because we're still addicted to this industry. And we often hear, you know, opponents to RGGI or renewable energy talking about jobs. But the reality is, even today in Pennsylvania, there are more clean energy and renewable energy, energy efficiency jobs than there are fossil fuel jobs in the state today. And if we plan for this transition, we can do it in a way that supports workers with jobs retraining, or, you know, sufficient early retirement instead of what's been happening where these plants suddenly just close and workers are also left in the lurch. And we can't keep, you know, even without our environmental, you know, work and those reasons, these industries just are less and less economically viable anyway. So it makes sense to me that we should be leading the way into the 21st century and investing in renewable energy and energy efficiency and those job programs and training programs here now, instead of like digging our heels in to this industry that's causing so many problems and is on its way out anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it makes complete sense. And it's one other point I would say before we segue talking about other kinds of bills is that this whole idea of, even it's other Dems, and even some of my elected officials that represent where I live here in Berks County, that were voting for, what was it, House Bill 1100, that was the one that provided the subsidies for the oil and gas industry. It's like, but it's all about jobs. And it's like, no, it's not. It's about the fact that you are still continuing this addiction to this dirty industry that is going to leave Pennsylvanians with nothing when they close down. All you're doing is you're just subsidizing an addiction. You're just throwing money away at something. At some point, is just gonna the industry is gonna die itself.
Yeah, and it's really frustrating because even from in that case, House Bill 1100, horrible, these huge handouts to some of the richest industries anyway in the country. Why do we need to give Shell billions of dollars in tax breaks when they've made all of their money polluting our environment and making people sick and causing climate change in the first place? But even dollar for dollar in job creation, we could spend a lot less of our taxpayer dollars to create a lot more family-sustaining jobs in other sectors. We don't need to only create jobs in fossil fuels. And in fact, it's very short-sighted, as you were saying, to do so.
So transitioning then to talking about the plastic bills too, because it's like now it seems as if we're not just extracting the natural gas from the Marcellus Shale for consumption and export, but also we're extracting like the ethylene to make n more petrochemicals or plastic-based products. So you mentioned about the whole thing about plastic bills. So let's go there next.
Yeah, I know. That's actually something that's pretty scary here in Pennsylvania right now. And the bill that you mentioned earlier, House Bill 1100, was exactly this, that we're now not just fracking gas and building pipelines to use natural, I don't like the term natural gas, fracked gas for energy, but actually to use it to make plastics, both exporting it abroad and right here in Pennsylvania. So there's certainly a concerted effort right now to turn Western Pennsylvania into the next Cancer Alley of Louisiana, by investing into this petrochemical build out. So, yeah, fracked gas to make plastics. And not only, right, does that mean more fracking, more pollution, more health problems, more pipelines across the state, but it also means more single-use plastics that we don't actually need and already have a huge problem with. So, of course, from a climate perspective, just using fuel to make plastics is a disaster for our climate and air pollution. But even the plastics themselves, there is no away on this planet. That's what sustainability is all about. We can use like a foam takeout container or a plastic cup for 5 minutes and throw it, quote unquote, away. But really, we're living on a closed system. That piece of plastic is going into often littering our communities, our rivers and streams and wildlife. I was doing a cleanup at John Hines, and every leaf I turned over, there was a tiny, tiny foam ball underneath, Like it's everywhere. Garbage patches in the oceans. And really, nothing that we use like that for 5 minutes should be able to pollute our environment for thousands and thousands of years. And so we need to end our addiction to single-use plastics, just like we need to end our addiction to fossil fuels and move towards a more sustainable zero-waste society. And digging into the, fracking to plastics industry here will only mean that, that future is even further out of reach. And I don't want anyone to, have any misunderstandings here. We have many bills in the state legislature that are being pushed by oil companies like Shell and Exxon explicitly because they see our energy makeup changing, and the fossil fuel industry has a concerted effort to ramp up plastic pollution so that they're still relevant. So it's a very intentional thing that they're doing, introducing bills across states to worsen our addiction to single-use plastics. And one example of that actually is House Bill 1808, which is currently moving in the state legislature. This bill would classify burning plastics to make fuel as recycling. This is a huge issue because folks that are normally with us see recycling and think it's a good thing. But really, this practice, which is chemical recycling, will just mean that we have a higher demand for plastics and fuel and more pollution. And it's really even worse than incinerating plastics is, which is already, we know, bad for us all and our health. So we've been working really hard to try to stop that bill from moving forward. So again, anyone listening can certainly call your state representative or senator to ask them to vote no on House Bill 1808, which is plastics to fuel, because certainly that would move us in the wrong direction. And I can maybe share with you, Shayna, some resources about why this practice is so harmful that you can share with listeners as well. But yeah, it just doesn't stop.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important thing to note. And as you were saying that, I was thinking about an article that was recently published on grist.org. I actually shared it on the podcast page, that it's titled, Want Some Eco-Friendly Tips? A new study says, no, you don't. And it's interesting to see, and I'll read a quote about this. It says, in fact, new research suggests that hearing eco-friendly tips like those actually make people less likely to do anything about climate change. Experts say that there are better ways to get people to adopt green habits, and they don't involve nagging and guilt tripping. And I think it's interesting, and why I wanted to point that out after you mentioned all of this, is it was either, I don't know if it was Exxon or if it was British Petroleum, came out with these campaign ads or like commercials within the last few years, that one was greenwashing themselves. So saying that, oh, we're transitioning to wind and all this other bullshit, basically saying of how great we are, but trying to still make their relevance known. But then I think it was British Petroleum ran a campaign. I don't know if they still do it, but they're like basically preaching to us as consumers on things that you can do to reduce your carbon footprint, or this is something you can do to reduce your carbon footprint. And it just goes to show the heavy manipulation that comes with these major corporations. And the fact that I think, I forget what the source of the statistic is, but it's like 70 companies around the world, a lot of them are fossil fuel companies, produce,
I think it's 100 companies.
Companies produce 70% of the world's emissions.
Yeah.
And just the fact that it's like these corporations are trying to clutch their pearls of any last like bit of power they have left, and they're trying to just recreate their relevancy. And at some point, I mean, I wish it was now, that we get to the point where it's like they're just not relevant at all anymore.
Yeah, I think we're luckily getting there, but not fast enough. But exactly, they're seeing the energy mix changing as renewable energy makes more and more sense economically, technology wise, that now, yeah, they're digging their heels in and moving more into plastics, because if they can, you know, make us all buy more plastics, they can keep, you know, producing fossil fuels. And the plastics thing is so evil to me, because we already recycle less than 10% of the plastics being produced and consumed in this country, We have a huge recycling problem. And, you know, a lot of the plastics that were given or sold in Pennsylvania can't even be recycled. And then instead of it being on these companies to deal with the waste that they're producing, it's put on the consumer. And exactly what you were just saying, instead of these 100 companies switching to renewable energy and cleaning up their systems and lowering their emissions, you know, we are told that we need to do all these lifestyle changes, which, you know, it's good for us to do. I try to stop buying as much plastic or ride my bike or walk instead of driving. And it's true that individual actions altogether do add up, but we need these companies and corporations to stop shifting the blame onto people and be responsible for cleaning up their own messes, whether it's the abandoned wells all over our state or these plastics that they're producing and the legacy of pollution that they've caused for decades. It should be their responsibility to clean up that mess, not ours.
Yeah, it's like this factor of rugged individualism. And just like after reading that study and kind of listening to some of the reports that came out related to it, it's like it only makes sense that when you bombard people too much, they're just going to give up.
Exactly.
And I mean, at the end of the day, that's what these large corporations want. They shift the blame onto the consumer and the consumer becomes burned out and then just is like, well, what does it matter?
Exactly. Or you feel guilty that you, you know, used a plastic straw one time and then are, you know, wrecked with guilt that you're not doing enough, and it causes folks to shut down instead of taking action. And the thing that I'd say there, and the reason that I do this job, is to try to give people easy ways to make their voice heard that are effective. Because if we all did things like call our elected officials or wrote to the paper, talked to our friends and family about climate change, and just helped, you know, to do our part there, making our voice heard, calling for these climate solutions, altogether, that's pretty powerful and can start moving things forward. And in the meantime, people need to be, I think, gentle on themselves, right? Like, we're all living in a society that's addicted to fossil fuels. There's not options for most of us to not, for a lot of us, depending on where you live, to not drive or to not use any plastics. It's pretty difficult, whether economic barriers, geographic barriers, to actually live a totally zero waste life today, because you go to the grocery store and everything's in plastic. So we really need to shift the systems that are forcing us all to be consuming these fossil fuels, not put it on the individual living in this system to change their entire way of life, which is why we focus so much on legislative solutions and advocacy, and as well as, you know, corporate accountability, because it's just, it's not a problem that we can solve by everyone, you know, using more efficient light bulbs, even though that's good. What we need is for these companies to change their act.
Yeah. And I was just wanting to step off there a second too. It's like, when talking about how there's not accountability for corporations and the fact that we're a very much a single-use wasteful lifestyle, I think it's fascinating how, I think it's across the EU. I don't think it's just like one particular company, or sorry, country in the EU, but how corporations have to have it as part of the fabrication process of any like major product that they produce. So like, let's say you buy an Apple computer in Germany and your computer becomes obsolete after a certain point. In the fabrication process of building that computer, the company has to take in mind of how they're going to dispose of the product.
The end of use.
Yeah, at the end of the use. So it really puts the whole, it really puts the whole circular economy concept into full use. And it just goes to show that it shifts the burden and the blame off of the consumer and puts the necessary burden onto the corporation to figure out what to do. And in that process, I don't know to the complexities of it all, But then that forces the company in some ways to reuse some of those products that are recyclable because they're going to spend more money disposing of it and acquiring new
Exactly.
resources than if they were to just recycle it in-house.
Exactly. And that's part of the problem right now, especially in the United States, is that it is just cheaper for these companies to consume more, oil and gas and make more plastic versus recycling because it's so expensive to recycle. So they're just so, and there's next to no producer responsibility. So there's just no incentives for these companies to change their act because they're not forced to deal with their waste. They're not paid to deal with the waste or not forced to pay to deal with the waste. It's just all put on the consumer. And not just the consumer, it's put on our municipal and county governments to deal with waste disposal. And if these companies were actually paying for all of these external costs of their pollution and waste, and environmental health harms, I think it would be much easier to get them to clean up their production. And certainly we need to be moving towards a circular economy, as you mentioned. And not only, do these companies here in the United States make it so difficult for us to dispose of waste and deal with this, but they're going hard into the other way. With planned obsolescence and with making it inaccessible to repair stuff so that we do just need to constantly be consuming new things. Our partner group, Penperg, has a whole campaign called Right to Repair right now, which, from like iPhones and Apple computer products to John Deere tractors and a lot in between, where we have these proprietary systems that, the norm when your iPhone breaks is to just get a new one instead of fixing it because you need to take it to, an approved Apple person to fix it. And wouldn't it be great if we could just fix our own technology and use it for longer instead of being incentivized to just buy a new thing every 2 years? And it's, Apple's just one example, but that's part of it too, I think, is if we sh could shift from a consuming culture to a sustainable culture where we are reusing and sharing, and re actually recycling instead of just consuming and disposing in an endless cycle.
Absolutely. And so kind of shifting gears back to like talking to about policy. So at the state, local, national level, when it comes to both climate and environmental policy, for you personally, and I guess for the work that you're doing with Penn Environment, what do you believe is at stake with this election?
Everything is really at stake. And I know it might sound like I'm overstating it, but it really is. The science is very clear, as I mentioned earlier. We need to get off of fossil fuels and transition to 100% renewable energy. We need to stop burning, carbon dioxide and methane in our atmosphere, or the impacts of climate change will just continue to worsen. And the longer we delay action, the worse it'll be, and the more people will suffer. So, the sooner that we can start this transition and actually start decreasing our emissions, the better. The sooner that we can do this transition and stop the worst impacts of climate change, the better. And we really cannot afford to wait 4 more years of, another Trump presidency with environmental and climate rollbacks and science denial because. I don't want to say it's ever too late because it's all a scale of the longer we wait, the worse it'll be. We need to try to act as soon as we possibly can. But waiting 4 years will make it next to impossible to be able to lower our emissions at the scale and rate and timeline that we need to stop, some of these worse impacts that the IPCC projected in its, I think, 2018 report about what we need to do to stay at 1.5 degrees of warming. And even that, which is so ambitious, is still horrible climate impacts. A lot of people around the world are going to suffer, a lot of people here in the United States. And if we just continue business as usual for, 4 more years or longer, our likelihood of being able to stop those impacts is very low. So the good news, though, is that we do, as we've discussed, have the technology and policy and public support that we need to implement climate solutions. And we're just missing the political will. And so I would say that, of course, we need to have more environmentally friendly people in office at every level, local, state, and federal, because if we don't have supportive people in office, we can't pass any bills. They block all of the things we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
But we also need all of us to stay engaged after Election Day, no matter who is in office, because in order to actually implement the bold solutions we need people on both sides of the aisle to be a lot bolder and more ambitious. Pennsylvania is a great example where, you know, there's Democrats in Western Pennsylvania that are worse on the environment than Republicans in Southeastern PA. So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't actually matter what side of the aisle you're on. We need everyone to be forced by public opinion to listen to scientists and implement the bold solutions that we need. And so we'll all need to keep making our voices heard to make sure that happens. But certainly that work is a lot easier if people who believe in science are in office.
Yeah, I think it's crucially important to kind of see that this is kind of, we're on the threshold of that passing the point of no return. I think it's also important to bear in mind not just what it means here in Pennsylvania, but even just thinking about that, what that means on a national scale and even on an international scale too.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think that the United States is really missing an opportunity here to be an international leader, as we've been in other areas before. You know, we should be using our science and technology and innovation to be leading the world to 100% renewable energy future, where we have mass electric public transit all over the country, and where we have, you know, solar on every roof and wind farms. And, you know, we should be leading the way, not only because we've contributed far more to the problem of climate change than most other countries, because of our industrialization, but also because it's just the right thing to do. You know, we laud our scientists and academic institutions when we don't listen to what they're telling us we need to do. And it really, I think, if the United States was leading the way, could help the rest of the world, who has been going on without us and are making, you know, much more strides, continue to do this as well. And certainly if we had leadership here at the national level, it would not only, I think, help the international conversation move forward at the scale and timeline we need, but also help us here in the United States at the state and local level implement things that'll actually help us on this transition faster as well, once there's that national mandate. So certainly, you know, having people in office at the national level who believe in science and are prioritizing climate action can kind of set the stage for industry, for states and local governments, for our international partners to follow.
Yeah, and I wanted to kind of pick that international part that you mentioned there out a little bit more, in the sense that officially, next Wednesday, November the 4th, the United States will now officially have resigned from the Paris Climate Accord. So even though we wouldn't be negotiating on that specific form of international policy, we still, as members of the UNFCCC, still would have to go to things like COP26, which will be next December or November. So we still have to be there, but we don't have a voice and we don't have anything to say. And almost a year ago, having recently gone to COP25, when the process pretty much began of the US leaving, and it's, in that sense, it was really messy to kind of watch how the U.S. had some presence, but it was really scaled down. And the fact that the U.S. was doing more counterproductive work than productive work. And because the week in which I was there and kind of saw some factors firsthand, it's like you had this congressional delegation. They put it like on themselves to go to COP25 and try to advocate for climate friendly legislation, which is great, but it just goes to show the state of despair in which the US is in right now, because of the fact that it was messy, where you had the Speaker of the House, who was the only highest elected official from the US that was there, trying to represent the US, but she's not a figurehead of the country. So it's just, it's all this messy factor and all these things into play, but it'll be interesting to see what happens with the election, because if a new administration comes to power in the time between the most recent COP25 to when COP26 happens, because if there is a new administration, in theory, there'll be little disruption of the U.S. part of those negotiations. Because I think, just like how President Obama did it, that you can sign an executive order pretty much to rejoin the Paris Accord. Now, the Paris Accord isn't perfect, but I think it's important that the symbolism in itself, that you have all these different countries from around the world that are sitting at the table talking about the same issues. And even though there's still injustices that happen, and the fact that indigenous communities are still being outcast to the smaller, more poor rural countries, to also island nations are not having a voice as much. But it's a weird experience being there in the presence of seeing how the U.S. is detached from all of it. And I don't even want to call the U.S. a wallflower in that sense, because that's speaking of pleasantries, I feel like, but
yeah,
it's just
hard to be a wildflower when we're polluting so much and causing so much problems.
But it's just like trying to give that metaphor and the context to it. But it's mind blowing. And I also wanted to point out something that you said earlier and highlight that more, is I read a white paper that the Rodale Institute recently published, and it's about agriculture's impact, especially big ag's impacts on climate change and what that means. And they were saying, in the time between them releasing this report this year to when they did their first report in 2014, 38 billion tons of carbon, sequestered carbon from the ground, was released into the atmosphere in just 6 years.
That's horrible.
38 billion tons. And in addition to that, they were saying, and I don't remember what the organization itself of researchers talked about, but they said that if we are at the current rate in which we are emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we're not going to get to that 1.5 degrees Celsius that we need to be at, that was in the International Governmental Panel on Climate Change report in 2018. But it's like they're saying projections are almost up to, I think it was like something like 2.5, 3 degrees to up to almost 4 degrees of an increase.
Yeah, I was going
to
say 4 was the number that was in my head.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
Yeah.
And the thing that scares me about that too, which I think a lot of people don't realize, because of decades of misinformation in this and questioning the science at the hands of the fossil fuel industry, I think there's still a misrepresentation or idea that climate scientists are overstating the problem, when really even our, you know, climate projections that are kind of worst case scenario are already happening now. Mm-hmm. Like the Arctic ice still hasn't frozen yet. It's late October. Like the things that we were projecting were a few decades from happening are actually happening now. And I think a lot of our projections are actually not as serious as things are going to get, which again just speaks to why we need action. And you're exactly right. The United States can't be a wallflower here. We've played a large role in this problem. We need to lead the way to a solution, and we need to be at the table internationally so that we can all work together to start, you know, a race to be what, which country can be 100% renewable energy first. Like, that's the kind of international competition that I would like to see, and us working together and sharing our technological innovations to help us get there. Because if we don't, you know, the impacts of climate change, while they of course are impacting indigenous communities, island nations, the global South more, poor communities and communities of color more here in the United States, everyone is going to be impacted by climate change, you know, in this half century. And so we really need bold action. The time to wait is, you know, there's no more time to wait. We should have been doing this for the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. And now that we haven't, we need much quicker action, and much bolder solutions now.
Yeah. And it just makes me think, back to what you were saying about the fact that we needed to do this for the last 40 years. And speaking to the context of the US especially, it's fascinating when traveling overseas to different countries that have taken the initiative to put the climate first or put themselves on a path of climate before the US has, that the US is not only going to have to start moving that ball, but they're going to have to jump over so many different hurdles. And that's not to say that underdeveloped nations, like, for example, in a lot of arguments, India is a part of them in the sense that they're still developing and they're a high polluter and they consume a lot of resources around the world. But the thing is, it's like they don't have the same infrastructural disadvantages we do, in the sense that it's like they can, the hurdles are a little different to jump over, because it's like they don't have to deconstruct a whole economy that we've built for the last 100 years that we're still addicted to. It's like, even though they're still developing in some places, it's, they can jump to that next stage.
Yeah, but they need, I think, the help and encouragement and support from the international community to do so. But I like to think of the analogy of like phones. Like, we wouldn't go and build landlines places without phone service to then tear them down to then put in cell phone towers. Like, we can just go right to cell phones, right?
Yeah.
Here, we need to dig into coal and oil and gas. We can just go straight to solar and wind.
Yeah.
But we need to actually make that effort to do so.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest challenge, is like just trying to tell people, it's like the current situation we're at, it's like we can't keep building this, because like you said, eventually we're going to have to tear it down to build new ones.
It's just unsustainable and it's stuck in the past. Like, it's 2020. We're well into the 21st century. We should have an energy system that matches this point in time where we are, where we do have clean, renewable energy powering our lives without polluting and making us sick and contributing to climate change. And we have the technological capacity to do it. So I sometimes get a little hopeless, because, you know, there's so many roadblocks, as you were saying, and hurdles to jump through. But on the other side of that, the US government today could decide our number one priority is electrifying, like, public transit, 100% renewable energy. We're putting all of our resources, creating jobs. Like, that's what we're doing. Like, the race to get to the moon. And we could do it and radically transform our society. You know, we've created society to be this way, and we can together build a society that actually is sustainable and works for everyone and protects our health and the environment and future generations. We just need to do it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's hard to keep that focus on the eyes on the prize in the sense of all of it, because I feel like I've dealt with bouts of nihilism too. It's like, what's the point when all there's just so many different competing factors that just keep that old guard in power? But I think this is a great segue to kind of start to wrap up with the last major question, in the sense that, so there's so much at stake locally and even arguably nationally when it comes to the environment and climate change in the upcoming general election. So for the listeners out there who are going to decide to vote in person or have not mailed in their ballot, which they already should have, or dropped it off at their county election services office, what is one thing that you want the listeners to take away with in regards to policy when voting next week?
Yes, I think that I want to say two things, if that's okay.
Yeah, go for
it. I don't want to get too into election politics right now, beyond to say, please vote with the environment and climate in mind. I'm a climate voter. I encourage people to consider the environment and climate as one of their top priority issues when casting your vote at every level, because the climate crisis is the existential crisis of our time. We all need a livable climate. If we don't have that, all of the other issues plaguing our nation and world right now are only going to get worse. So I encourage you to vote with the climate in mind. But to bring back something I said earlier, the main thing I need everyone to take away from this is that Election Day is really just the beginning. What we need is a mass movement of people all coming together, making our voices heard, writing and calling to your elected officials, lobbying them, going to rallies and climate strikes, and really making it clear that the United States, the people here, the people of Pennsylvania, demand bold climate action. We need to make it explicitly clear that there is a mandate to get off of fossil fuels and go to this renewable energy future. So the election is important, but please don't think of it as the end of the work. It's really just the beginning, because the organizing after the election to actually get, you know, solutions implemented is the thing that'll make the biggest difference.
In addition to what you were saying about the fact that this is only just the beginning, things don't end on election day. So regardless of who is especially elected as president with this election, is whether it's Trump or if it's Biden, that doesn't mean you're going to sit at home and say, okay, I did what I could, and drown yourselves in joy or sorrows, whatever it may be. The work doesn't end there. Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, and this is something I wanted to highlight too with this episode, is there's been a lot of controversy in the news lately about a lot of environmental issues that are addressed to us as Pennsylvanians. And the fact that fracking seems to be a hot button issue to attract Pennsylvanians, and the fact that there's this banter back and forth between Trump and Biden about, you know, who's going to ban fracking or who will not like ban fracking. Both of them are tone deaf. One is more definitely tone deaf than the other one is. But just the fact that it's like, you're not willing to step out ahead and understand that like fracking is so damaging and toxic to Pennsylvania. I won't ban fracking, but I'll remove all the subsidies of major fossil fuel companies, which is great.
Yeah, that's an important step.
That's an important step. But then I'm thinking, okay, well, you can take the glory of them going out of business when they do, because they need money to survive. But yes, you're not,
a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, but you're not like, you're not taking that initiative to really pull the reins in and say, you know what, not only am I going to defund them, but also we need to figure out a plan for them to go out of business and have new companies and a transition to green jobs. And it's just,
yes,
understanding the fact that both candidates, regardless if it's for president or if it's for local houses here in Pennsylvania state districts or something like that, is the work doesn't end on election day.
Everyone needs to be pushed to be bolder. And that's where the, you know, people-powered movements can come in. Fracking is a great example where actually the majority of Pennsylvanians do support ending fracking and do see the destruction it's caused. To your point, the industry is barely economically viable, even with a lot of government handouts. And yet there's this narrative that persists, whether it's in New York Times pieces or on the presidential debate stage, that if a candidate, you know, came out against fracking, they would lose the state. Whereas really here in Pennsylvania, we've been having more and more people running and winning elections at the local and state level on banning fracking and holding these companies accountable. So we're definitely at a point where I think the leaders across the political spectrum are entrenched in this fossil fuel status quo. And we need all of the majority of the people that actually are with us and want a livable climate and want clean air and clean water and want a safe, healthy environment to raise their family in. We need all of us to make our voices heard and push everyone at wherever they are across this political spectrum to be even bolder and implement the truly transformative solutions that we need.
Absolutely. And I feel like that's a good place to stop before we end the discussion altogether. I thought we would kind of wrap up with some maybe not as stressful, more lighthearted questions than a lot of the heavy policy stuff, and allow the listeners to kind of just digest a little bit of what we've been talking about. So, in your opinion, what do you think is the definition of sustainability?
I think of sustainability as all of us, you know, humans, humanity, working, playing, living on this planet in absolute harmony, you know, with nature, with the environment, with other species, in a way that allows us to thrive and grow, while also allowing the planet, animals and plants, the entire biosphere to thrive and grow free from exploitation and pollution and destruction. So I really see it as kind of us all living in a circular harmony.
So if you, everything you just said, and if you were to sum it up into one word, what would it be?
Can I do two words and say circular economy?
Sure. It's interesting to hear.
Or just circular, maybe on its own could be, yeah, could be the word.
It's just interesting to hear people's different responses over the episodes, as far as like where people are coming from and thinking about how they approach sustainability.
What word that comes to mind when you hear sustainability?
So some people are a little more literal, I guess, in the sense that somebody in the past was just like flat out sustain to, I think someone said regenerative, another one was green. So it's interesting to see where people's thought processes play into that and how they approach it. So my next question, to an earlier point we made as far as individual things that people can do to reduce their carbon footprint, and one of those that's always being pushed is to delve into a more hybrid or full out vegan diet and lifestyle. Have you ever dabbled into trying veganism? And if you have, what would be your favorite vegan dish?
Yeah, that's a great question. I try to eat mostly plant-based, though I do eat cheese sometimes. It's like the one, and maybe some ice cream are my kind of two holdouts. But I would say that what I've come to realize and what I hope listeners can take away is that all of us eating as few animal products as possible, all of us trying our best to eat less meat, eat less dairy, eat more local food for sure that's not being shipped across the world and country, the better. And if all of us, you know, ate slightly less meat and slightly less dairy, that would make a huge difference. I mean, I know some people are scared of the idea of going fully vegan. So I want to just say that first, that I think reducing How we can is a good first step. And when I first became a vegetarian a few years ago, I kind of just did it on a whim and was like, let's just see how it goes. And it was so much easier than I thought. But I do like to eat vegan. And one of my favorite vegan dishes, well, it's more of an ingredient that I'm obsessed with, is the Upton seitan chorizo. I'm fully obsessed with it. I use it to make, you know, veggie burritos or bowls. You could add it to a tofu scramble for a chorizo, you know, Mexican flair, eat it with chips. You can really do anything, but that's the thing that I've been most obsessed with lately is that seitan chorizo, because I'm a big Mexican food fan.
Yeah, it's interesting. So recently, like, I've had to make some diet changes, so I can't consume dairy at all. So occasionally I'll like eat meat sometimes, but when I don't eat meat, it's like I have no choice other than to be a hybrid vegan in that sense. And it's been interesting kind of trying to experiment with substitutes in place of dairy. So I guess flipping around the question to myself, one of the things that I'm a huge fan of, and I work also at a local vegan cafe, so shout out to the Greenhouse Cafe. They make this like it's like a frittata slash like like it's kind of like a quiche style texture. It's called the strata, but just like the way it's seasoned with the chickpeas, like you would never, it's like when you start to like dabble into really well-cooked vegan dishes, it's like, why would I go back to eating
exactly
dairy or eating meat all the time when a lot of these dishes, it's like I don't really miss it.
Yeah, vegan food can be so delicious. I think that's a big misconception. I personally love eating fruits and vegetables anyway, but the things that you can do now with vegan cooking are incredible. And I really encourage folks to go visit that cafe or just, you know, pick one day a week or even one meal a week to start where you'll eat vegan. And it is a lot easier than and more delicious than you might think.
Yeah. And it's more than.
And if you can't go.
Oh, it's just, sorry. No, that's okay. I was just going to say it's more than just eating salads.
Exactly. And salads are good, but you know, that's boring. And even if you can't, as I said, can or don't want to, life's hard. I get it. Fully go vegan, eating just meat less often, dairy less often, eating local when you can go so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And my last question is, in addition to the amazing work you already do, if you had a dream job in sustainability, what would it be and why?
Okay, so I have this vision of a dream job. I've never shared it, so I'm excited to get the opportunity to do so today, of ripping out people's lawns, like grass lawns, and replacing them with native plant meadows or vegetable and herb gardens. The reason being that lawns, especially when people have lawns in like the Southwest or West Coast, like where you really shouldn't have grass, it's just so resource intensive in terms of water. And the land could be so much better, like put to better use with native plants that help, you know, regenerate, that help native ecosystems, birds, etc. But also do a better job sequestering carbon or help people grow their own food in a vegetable garden. We could just be using our resources around our homes so much better. And instead we're wasting a ton of water growing lawns. For what reason? Because we're told that we need to have a nice green lawn to like have this model of American, you know, white picket fence home ownership. So yes, I would love to rip out people's lawns.
That sounds like I could definitely see you taking joy and pleasure out of that. Like I could see you in action doing it.
Exactly. And then you could have a nice, beautiful native plant meadow, which is much nicer to look at anyway, or a nice vegetable garden. So Or if you live in the West, you know, succulents and rocks. You chose to live out there. You don't need a lawn.
Touche. Touche, for sure.
Yeah. I know that's controversial, but that's my dream.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks so much, Flora, for coming on the show and for a lively discussion. And I think an important one, especially before the election. So for the listeners out there, make sure if you haven't done so already and you decided to vote by mail or vote by a provisional ballot, whatever it may be, without going to the actual polling place, is drop that ballot off as ASAP as possible. Because here in Pennsylvania, if it is not dropped off at your county's election services office by next Tuesday, November 3rd, 8 p.m., your vote will not count. Your vote will not count if you don't drop that mail-in ballot, or if you can arrange for the post office to deliver it by next Tuesday, 8 p.m. So, any last thoughts, Flora?
Yes, I would love to just quickly plug, if you heard this and are interested in getting more involved, Penn Environment has a ton of ways to make your voice heard, whether it's volunteering or just the occasional call to your elected official. So certainly I encourage listeners to follow at Penn Environment, P-E-N-N Environment, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, to get updates, urgent actions on legislation, as well as event invitations and things like that. So certainly, you know, follow us on social media, stay up to date. And if you're interested in volunteering, there's so many ways to get involved. So folks can certainly reach out to me as well. My email is Flora, F-L-O-R-A, at pennenvironment.org.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Flora.
Thank you so much, Shayna. Thanks for being so sustainable.
Yeah. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Sustaining with Shayna. You can now listen to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Anchor.fm, and many other platforms. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and, of course, leave a review or comment. To follow us on Facebook or Instagram, go to sustainingwithshayna.com. Also, what you read and listen to here on the platform was carefully created and curated content made just for you, the listeners. Any generous donations can help to keep me supplying you with great content. Just go to Sustaining with Shayna's website. Click on the donate page to donate. Glad you're here. Thanks a million for listening.